Attention Austin musicians and music industry professionals. Are you having a difficult time navigating these waters, especially after the coronavirus and all the clubs have been closed? You don't know what to do? Well, let me tell you about a great resource for you. That's the Austin Music Foundation. Austin Music Foundation provides ongoing artist development services through its educational panels, one-on-one consultations, and online resources. Now listen, gang, all of that stuff is available to you, the artist or music industry professional, for free. And since coronavirus hit back in March and everything is closed down, Austin Music Foundation had the forethought to move all of their programs online. That's right, you can watch panels online, you can do your consultations online. Austin Music Foundation is there for you, and it's all free to you, the artist. Just go to austinmusicfoundation.org. That's austinmusicfoundation.org. Get involved. Attention Austin guitarist, are you in need of setup or repair on your axe? Well, I have the guy for you. That's my friend Jason Swedberg over at J. Scott Luthrie. You can find him at J. Scott Luthrie on Facebook. Gang, I've been taking my guitars to Jason for over 20 years, and not only does he do the very best job, but he has the fastest service and the best prices in town. Find him at J. Scott Luthrie on Facebook or jason.swedberg@gmail.com. Gang, whether it's acoustic or electric, Jason is your guy. Get your guitars fixed.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here? And now here is your host, Johnny Maldi.
When we talk. All right, hello. I'm Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I hope you guys have all had a good week, or at least tried to have a good week. It's getting fucking crazy out there, man. Not only is the Republican National Convention going on, I won't even touch on that right now, but Jacob Blake, still, that, like, he didn't get killed, but he got shot 7 times in front of his kids by police. Like, this is the thing we've been talking about. We've been talking about how horrible this is. This is the thing that's defining America. It's defining who we are. It's defining the system that we've set up. To the rest of the world, to ourselves, definitely to black and brown people alike. It's insane. It's insane, and it needs to stop. I don't know how it's going to stop. You got all these fucking guys at the Republican National Convention, you with this law and order shit. And this, you know, I'm doing this on Thursday. I haven't seen the president speak yet because he hasn't spoken yet in my world. But I did see the vice president speak, and man, what an asshole. Seriously, like, there was so much weird shit, like the preserve our heritage thing or take back our heritage, whatever the hell that's supposed to mean. Making America great again. They're threatening that if Joe Biden takes over, it's going to be lawlessness. Like, what you see now will be happening. It's like it's happening now under your administration. Whatever the, I don't know. It's just, it's disgusting. It's disgusting. I'm disgusted. I'm sickened. Not in a good mood about it today. I just had a great conversation with my friend James Robinson, who's the guy that urged me to have these conversations with my black friends, people in the music community. I'm meeting people. Today's guest is no different. I was talking to him about it today. And I guess sometimes when I get off the phone with him, I'm a little fired up. And, I am. It sucks. You know, this has been happening for a long time. This police shit has got to stop. My guest today is Sam Houston, black rock star. He lost his brother to police brutality. We talk about it. It's very, very, you know, it's heavy. It defined who he is as a person. It was inspiration for writing music for him, to get out there, to spread the word, to let people know. Sam Houston is a phenomenally talented artist, phenomenally talented. Amazing songwriter, fantastic producer, amazing singer, looks cool as shit. Like, that's all part of the deal too. Like, you gotta look cool, and he looks cool as shit. So anyway, it turns out I've never met him before. I've been watching him on a lot of these live streams that have been going on. You might have seen him. He was on, of course, Blues on the Screen. That was the Jackie Venson curated Blues on the Green live stream that was on television. He's been on a lot of them since. Chaka's live stream. A lot of different live streams here in town. And he's a phenomenal artist. Phenomenal. He's working on new music. I got to see this video. You can see this video for this song of his called Riot in the Streets. And I love that song, man. Incredible song. But he said it's not ready for release yet. He's re-recording it. That video, you can watch it, though. You can get the energy from this great song. You can check out his EP, April, which is available on all the streaming services. You can find him at samhoustonmusic.com. I had a really great time talking to Sam and getting to know him. He's a really, really amazing dude. He's working over at 512 Studios, owned by my friend Omar Vallejo, one of the great Vallejo brothers. Well, they're all great brothers. I just call him one of the great Vallejo brothers. Anyway, Sam Houston, black rock star, fascinating dude, incredibly talented, and we have a great conversation. So please enjoy my conversation with black rock star and super cool dude in my book, Sam Houston. Let's get down.
Got me in my soul. Am I glad that you don't know? Glad that you don't know that you've got control, girl.
You like working there?
It's tight, man. I've got a band coming in from New Jersey next week.
That you're producing?
Like Rage Against the Machine vibe. Say that again.
That you're producing?
Yeah, that I'm producing.
Awesome, man.
And I'm working on a couple other band stuff and doing some stuff with Adrian Quesada and some new White Denim stuff.
That's great. Wait, White Denim?
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Man, so you...
Good stuff, and I'm excited about it.
Yeah, you got a lot of stuff coming up. But what about, when am I going to be able to listen to Riot in the Streets all the time? Dude, that's a great song, man.
Thank you, man. We just kind of finished arranging the actual album version. The thing that's on YouTube is sort of just like a session kind of thing. But or it was kind of really created for that live video, but we are... We just kind of finished like arranging how the actual record would sound and added a bridge to it and, you know, a chorus out. So hopefully we get to record it within the next couple of weeks. I mean, we don't have any restraints. As soon as we're able to put stuff out, like, you know, as far as like streaming and we have it recorded and mastered, I'm hoping like early September, man. You know, there's not much going on and we're not waiting for any record label pitching or anything like that. For the live industry to come back around to get into that again. But right now we're just kind of, I'm working on, you know, the production and the things and, you know, I want to put music from my band out as well, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Do you, you and Alejandro Rios produce your stuff, right?
I'm the producer. He just plays guitar in the band.
Okay. Okay. So you are the producer. You're the visionary. It's interesting because I told you earlier that I saw that email from you when I was looking up the Zoom thing for this, and when I read it, because when I was watching you on Blues on the Screen a few weeks ago, I was like, fuck, man, that guy is so cool. Like, I don't, like, it was intimidatingly cool. Like, you're so cool, it made me feel like super uncool watching you. Okay. And so I go back and read this super humble, like, hey, man, I saw you doing this panel last night. Here's my tune. Like, check it out. I'm glad that I wasn't a dick. But yeah, dude, what a great, that was a great thing to see. And to, it kind of, it made me less intimidated for this conversation.
No, hey, dude. That was 2016. It was a few months after I had moved here from New Jersey. I was fresh out of high school. And, you know, I did feel the need to do a lot of cold reach outs and cold calling, you know, so to get my name out. And I think that, you know, ultimately it helped get doors open. And, you know, once the doors opened, I don't know if I was quite ready to get on stage. but, you know.
Well, it's funny that you say that, because now you really are like a you. I mean, at least to me, you seem like a fully realized artist. Like, you are Sam Houston. There's no like, well, he needs to go back in the oven for a couple hours. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a good journey, man. Especially crowd development here, with some of the reputable sources in town saying that we're one of the best bands in town. It definitely did help. And, I guess the goal from the start was sort of to bring something unique to the table. I spent a lot of time watching and listening to music in Austin before I even, you know, sort of a strategic thing. I would go out to shows. I would watch, you know, the bands that were considered to be the best bands and sort of ask myself, all right, well, how could we beat them? How could we be at that level? How could we make the crowds here react the same as, you know, these people are making the crowds react? So it was a long, you know, period of studying almost and all, like familiarizing myself with the scene and trying to get my name out, even if it's digitally, like how I reached out to you and just kind of put the name in the air. So, you know, maybe if somebody had mentioned it to you, you would say, oh, I heard of that kid. I heard that name somewhere. And it may not have been like right at the front of your mind, but just that familiarity or the simple, oh, I heard that name somewhere, actually has done a lot for us, you know, in town and out of town as well. So it was sort of a strategic planning of just trying to, like, slowly but surely put our name in front of people.
Yeah, yeah. I work with the Austin Music Foundation. I know that Emily Miller over there and Einar Peterson are huge, huge fans of yours as well.
Love those guys. They're awesome.
Yeah, so how have you been doing for the last 6 months, like, locked down?
It's been weird, man. I mean, you know, we were supposed to be in Europe, and we were supposed to be doing some touring in the States. We were actually doing this Army base tour.
Oh, really?
In Europe. Yeah, it was going to be super cool.
Was it going to be like a USO kind of thing?
I think so. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah.
But my management was taking care of it. But, you know, like, it's been difficult, man, because we had so much things leading up. We got with William Morrison Agency, and, you know, we had a ton of good looks from record labels. You know, we weren't there yet, but we were definitely in talks with them. And we were getting ready to head out to...
Sorry, you were ready to head out where?
We were headed out to Nashville to work on an album with the Leon Bridges team.
Wow.
And it all kind of just... Phew.
Yeah. So you're with the William Morris Agency?
I have an agent over there. Yeah,
that's amazing, man. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. Right now we can't use it.
No. Do you do... I mean, is there... How have you been able to put yourself out there? Outside of the Black Everything Matters that Chaka did and Blues, I guess, yeah, those were, that's the way you're doing it. But is there any other way you're doing it?
Well, obviously I'm in the band and I'm the lead singer of the band, but by default I'm more of a producer. And that's kind of what I'm more focused on right now. At the moment, I'm working here at the studio and bringing clients in, and really, you know, my job, as I see it right now, is trying to take 512 Studios and bring more of a name to it, like in Ireland. I'm trying to really push out some quality projects and have some stuff come out of here that is as notable as that of, like, the Black Pumas or Gary Clark Jr., the stuff from White Denim. So I work with all those. I don't work with Gary, but I work with those guys, but I don't work at their studios. So what I'm trying to do is build sort of that same, you know, kind of pipeline over here,
yeah,
and just really good records, and then take some of the connections that I've been able to make in the industry and sort of shop them. So it's kind of like a, I think that's what a producer should do. I think, you know, when you look to hire a producer, it should be somebody that, you know, works really hard on the record, and then after you're finished, doesn't just say, okay, go and upload it or give you a couple CDs. So like, you know, the bands that I'm working with that need it, I'm really keen on trying to make those introductions, whether it be like them needing some management help out in Nashville or Los Angeles or New York or Atlanta. And also, you know, putting in them, you know, in touch with other artists or
right.
touring people that be able to help them and stuff like that. You know, just really trying to develop the project to as big of a level as I can. And that's only a certain threshold. I can only do so much, but I fear, you know, if I get to that level, then, you know, it'll be highly appreciated when it goes to the next level after that.
Yeah. Well, dude, when I was listening to Ride in the Street, and I'm sorry to focus on this song so much, but it affected me in a way, and I really, as somebody who is just by default a rock musician, like I'm 51 years old, I came up in the thing, you know, with Omar and stuff like that, and was in a band with Anar for many years from Austin Music Foundation, and I feel like there's this thing that people talk about, like rock is dead, rock doesn't have really a place anymore. But when I heard Ride in the Streets, and even more than the way that I reacted to your EP April, I felt like Ride in the Streets, not only is it a great song, I felt like, oh, this is where rock and roll can go and live and keep on going. How do you even view what you do musically?
Ride in the Streets was sort of a, and it's still in its development. Like I was saying, we kind of finished it, but Ride in the Streets was like a cross between contemporary music that I've grown up on and that culture in general, and sort of the ramifications and sort of happenings that culture brought into my life, which weren't always the happiest. So, rock and roll wasn't something that I like sought out to do, but I felt somewhere in my career, pretty much in the beginning, like maybe about 2017 when we played our first show, that the soft stuff that you heard from the April EP was not letting me express what I really felt about the things that surrounded us in life. So discovering the rock and roll aspect or pocket, if you will, or, you know, of the band sort of gave us more of an opportunity and more of a route to be more expressive and be more deliberate with the message and sort of bring more urgency with it. I can't say, you know, it may be frowned upon, but I can't say that I spent my life studying the Led Zeppelins and the Black Sabbaths and all the people that were taking ideas from at this point. But in more recent years, I really have dove into it and dove into the culture. And my thing is always fusion. Like, what can bring all the black people to the shows? What can bring all the white people to the shows? What's going to bring the Asian people to the shows? What's going to bring all the girls? Because if you bring all the girls, you know all the guys are going to come. What is going to bring everybody to the shows? And I'm finding it more and more as time goes on, especially in this pandemic, as I really have time to look. Because since, you know, around the time I sent you those emails, you know, while I was sending that to you, I was sending it to a dozen other people, you know what I'm saying? And just trying so hard.
There's a part of me that fantasizes that you just wrote me. But go ahead, sorry.
we were just trying so hard to do something, man, and the more I have time to just sit and look now, I'm noticing more and more that the fusion of different genres and really tastefully bringing them together to create something that, if you're a hip hop fan, you can rock your head during the chorus, but if you're a soul fan, you can listen to the vocals. the backup vocals and say, damn, this is real soulful. But if you're a rock fan, when the chorus hits and it's like, it's real heavy and it's like, damn, I could really enjoy different aspects, and now we're bringing different crowds to each other. So other than it being a political message about obviously the different things that are going on, we released it on YouTube a little bit before the whole George Floyd thing happened, because it's been true to something that me and my family and my brothers have experienced in life for a long time now. So, you know, Riot in the Streets was really about literally that, you know, and I don't know if the lyrics are clear enough in that YouTube version, but, you know, it says that we're running from the police and we're running from the government. And I use that analogy, running, because it's how we feel even when we walk out the house sometimes. Like, we feel like we're running. We feel like we've been running since the day that we could walk. So it's like, I use that analogy and with urgency in the music, and say that there's a riot in the streets, and then the big line hits, doom, 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 and then I wanted it to be a real haunting line, something that sounded almost like Armageddon-ish. And, yeah, man, I've been listening to a ton of music. That's sort of where I get a lot of inspiration from, listening, just seeing how people react to stuff.
Yeah.
I encourage that you as a rock, you know, connoisseur and someone that has done rock for, I'm sure, all of your life.
Yeah.
I'm encouraged to hear the approval of it, though, because I didn't study much of it.
Oh, yeah. And to me, it's not even so much that there's any kind of influence. I mean, it kicks into like this high energy guitar fucking thing in those choruses. But those verses, like, there's what I call an expensive chords going on that you hear in like R&B and stuff. But the melody to me in those verses is like truly unique, like something that you might not experience because you're so much younger than me. And I don't know who this touchstone would be for you, but like the first time as a kid, you went from hearing like Boston on the radio and hearing like these square kind of like rock Journey and shit like that. And then all of a sudden you hear this melodic quality from this band U2. And all of a sudden, they're singing like a different kind of... It's making the hair on my arm stand up. But that's the feeling that I got, especially from those verses from you. I was like, oh, this is a new... That's what I was saying, like, you were moving the needle forward with rock and roll. Like, you were taking whatever rock and roll was left for you and, like, sweeping it into a thing with your own fairy dust and spreading it out over the thing, which to me has the spirit of rock and roll. To me is like freedom. You know, it's like, you know,
I want that for sure.
Yeah. Like whatever it is that made like Chuck Berry be able to do it. That was freedom. You know, whatever the Sex Pistols were doing, that was freedom. You know,
absolutely. Very true.
Anyway, so let's, if you don't mind talking about it, you lost your brother to police violence. Is that correct?
Yeah, I did. 2010.
And that was in Plainfield, New Jersey?
Patterson, New Jersey. I was born in Plainfield.
Okay.
That happened in Patterson.
Where is Patterson in relation to?
It's Passaic County. It's sort of closer to like the New York area.
Right. Like in the Asbury Park vicinity?
No, Asbury Park is more towards the shore.
Right.
Patterson is like sort of, you know, not too far from like the Holland Tunnel and stuff like that. I'm not too sure if you're. It's more in that suburban sort of town. I mean, New Jersey has a whole bunch of small parts and stuff like that, but Patterson is a really like urban, vibrant city that obviously has its issues with crime, and police brutality is a very huge thing over there. And it's been for years. But, you know, Patterson is where it happened.
And what happened? Was your...
He was... So my brother suffered from bipolar, and he was in the program, and, you know, things were going, you know, fairly well. And some sort of instance happened, and, you know, I'm still not clear on the details because it's a very weird story, but some sort of instance happened where there was a false accusation of him having a weapon, and the people that are hired and are supposed to de-escalate situations like that, that's their literal job when you're dealing with somebody who's deemed.
So sorry, we got interrupted there, but you were saying that the people that are, that job it is to de-escalate a situation like that did not.
No, they did not. In fact, they just, I guess, called the police, which in Patterson is, in a situation like that, is a very high chance that it's a death sentence, because it's just their process and the way they do things is so wrong. And, you know, my family to this day is pursuing things like sending letters to Congress. And,
sure,
you know, it was so, but I'll sort of let you know about that. But long story short, whatever happened and however the message was, you know, perceived from the person who made the call to the police department, there must have been some sort of miscommunication, because like the whole SWAT team showed up and, you know, a SWAT truck and dozens of cops. And my brother was still in his home at the time. And he was obviously scared. I couldn't imagine the fear that you go through when you realize that there's people pointing guns at your house, and there's probably 40, 50, 60, maybe police officers and SWAT teams outside, and they're all pointing guns at you. I mean, we have never faced a fear like that. So, you know, my brother started running. He jumped out of his back window, and he tried to, you know, get out of that area and get off the scene. And while he was running, you know, they shot him from the back, and they shot at him 70 times total.
Jesus Christ. I'm sorry, man.
Yeah, man. It's absolutely ridiculous. If you just look at him, he was hit 11 times, but
yeah,
there's 70 rounds shot at him. You know, I don't know in what world or what, you know.
Yeah, there's no
instance you need that for one person who's running from you. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know why that would be the way that they did things, but that's how it happened. And yeah, man, I mean, when they made claims that my brother shot at them, but, you know, if you look on the autopsy report, that was a public record. There was no gunpowder anywhere on his body, which means it was literally impossible that he shot a gun. So certain things don't add up, but just at the time, we didn't have the financial wherewithal to carry through with it. And then there was someone that had a video of the whole thing that happened. But by the time we got to them, the dude had moved to the Dominican Republic, and he said that the police was harassing his family. And my father spoke with the guy and said the police was harassing his family. And, you know, he got up and left, and he left the country. Like, he went back to his home in Dominican Republic and took his family. And that has sort of been the end of that.
But there hasn't been any kind of trial or anything.
No, because it happened. It went to you know, the courts, and there was two other cases that were being like sort of looked at, and at the same time, the prosecutor squashed both of those and said, it is what it is, and, you know, kind of just got brushed away with the rest of the senseless killings that happened in that time frame, 2010, 2011. So the department didn't really start getting broken down on until videos started going viral of them planting drugs on during arrest. And people were, I mean, it was so evident, these people, like, what was going on. We sort of missed that window, but, you know, it's never too late. And with, you know, the right, you know, success and financial wherewithal, if it at that point even matters to go after the people that did it, then, you know, it can. But at this point, me and my brother, who's actually sitting right over here.
Hey, man.
How's it going?
We sort of like, we found that probably the best thing in that situation was forgiving and telling ourselves that we forgive the people that did that. And that's way more powerful than, you know, them going to jail or some sort of justice happening. I mean, justice is good, but until you have, you know, justice or forgiveness inside of you, it's not going to make much of a difference, because he's never coming back. We know that. So, I mean, yeah, it would be good to see it just so it didn't happen in the future to other families. But as for us, we've gone through our own, you know, process of, you know, healing and justifying the situation with ourselves. So,
just for conversational sake, my mom was murdered when I was a teenager, not by the police or anything, but like a crazy boyfriend who owned a recording studio here in Austin. But he,
that's fucking,
yeah. And there was, there, it was a cold case for a long time. And then it got solved like, you know, 25 years later or something like that. And then they ended up letting him out for some kind of weird sort of, thing that I won't even go into, but I understand where you're coming from with that. But the one thing about all of this that must be so difficult for you and your brother and your whole family is that this hasn't stopped happening to other people's brothers and children.
Right.
At all.
Yeah. Give me one second. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I don't know if I see it stopping, because even with this whole Black Lives Matter thing and with all the different support that people have been getting, nothing like painting Black Lives Matter on Congress Avenue and on Main Street in Washington and all these different athletes wearing the shirts. It's great to bring notoriety and awareness to what's going on. That is the first step. But until we see policy change
exactly
within the cities, on a local level, on a state level, and then on a national level, until there's actual policy changes, and it starts with the small towns. That's the biggest thing. You won't see half of these little small towns in Texas or California change the rules that they've had for the last 100 years. And that's the reason why, as a whole, you know, when is all of this going to stop? People change as generations go on. You know, I think the newer generation, they're a lot more tolerant and they have a lot more access to the information all over the world. So, or someone that grew up in the 40s, even the 50s or 60s, and their parents were racist and they didn't have any way out of that, it's difficult for them to learn anything else. But with the internet and Twitter and Instagram, and to see how frowned upon that is and how much these kids are into that and how much that is always in front of them, I think that that is a positive thing that social media does for us. And, you know, I think that that's a positive thing that the next few generations will have is definitely a lot more tolerance and understanding and compassion, just because it's like the whole cancel culture thing, and you don't want to be caught being that one person. So with that, I think everything heals in time, but at the same time, there needs to be some sort of policy change to say that certain things just can't happen, and if they do, you have to be held accountable as a murderer.
Yeah. Do you feel like, when you were saying that things change on a local and state level, do you find those changes can be attained through paying attention who your local leaders are and voting for them, from like sheriff to judge to like city council person, like, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's always a huge part of it. And it's important that we select our leaders carefully and that we know that they have the best interest in us. I'm obviously a huge advocate for that. And I think that, you know, we should continue to put the right people in the seat to represent us.
Yeah. Yeah. How old are you?
23.
So your first voting was in 2016?
Yeah. 2016, I believe. Right? So, no, actually, I turned 18 in New Jersey, so.
Okay.
I think 2015. Yeah. Well, no, 2016. You're right. I think that sounds about right.
Yeah. Sorry, I was just wondering, because I feel like the first voting thing, like you just kind of go crazy and vote, and then it's as you get older, you start kind of like going like, well, I don't know who the hell this city council person is. You know what I mean? But that's the person right. that can make a direct difference in your life. You know, if you need a light changed on your street.
And I'm not going to like get on here and say, oh, like, I think you should vote Republican or Democrat. I actually don't have a preference at all. I don't disagree with everything that Republicans
exactly.
Have in their ideologies. And I don't disagree with everything that Democrats have. I'd say that I probably play more of the center, I think, on as far as some practical issues. I don't know. It's kind of hard for me to say. I know there's some shaky things that happen within the Republican Party on a moral standpoint, but just the same in the Democratic Party. I mean, and people are so confused with that, especially Black people. So, I never will publicly or anything like that say you should vote Democrat or Republican. I never would do that because I just don't believe that, you know, a certain group of people should be marginalized to one party. I think research about who the person is and what the goals are.
Right. What they stand for.
Right. I thought Pete Buttigieg would have been an awesome runner for the Republican Party, to be honest. I thought he would have been great. And I thought that would have been great for that party as well. Because some of his views seemed a bit conservative, but at the same time, he had obviously some moral values that he wasn't willing to compromise. And I liked that a lot.
Yeah.
I thought he would have been interesting.
Do you... But like, is there anything do you get behind like a candidate? Like you say you wouldn't go vote Republican, don't vote Democrat, but somebody like Pete Buttigieg, if you believed in him and he was running for president, would you as an artist go do fundraisers and shit for him if he asked?
Man, I don't know. I suppose, you know, I liked Beto O'Rourke. I thought that, I liked him a lot, and I would have definitely, I would have definitely got behind what he was doing and loaned whatever platform I do have to, you know, his was bigger than mine, but you know, I would have loaned whatever I could, you know, to help him.
Yeah.
And, I suppose in a sense I would definitely get behind it. I would just have to make sure that what they're doing
is what you believe
really
in.
Aligns with the message I put out, and I'm sure they would have to do the same with us because we can get a little bit out there sometimes. But
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
man, sure.
All right, so let's go back into the studio, or let's go back to Plainfield, New Jersey, Patterson, New Jersey. Where did you get introduced to music to where it affected you to the point that you became a music man?
So Patterson is where my brother passed away, but Plainfield is where I grew up. So okay. You were right the first time.
Okay.
Plainfield is a super like huge city for music and basketball, and my brothers played ball, and I was in music, and. It also is the town where the famous band Parliament Funkadelic was founded, and actually where they still live today. The family still lives there, and I grew up with the grandkids, and I grew up with the nieces and nephews and stuff like that. So by default, that whole funk thing and that style of music and that era of music was ingrained since I was like literally came out the womb. So the bass player in my band now is a descendant of Funkadelic, and
His
uncle is Diaper Man. Yeah, yeah.
His uncle's Diaper Man?
Yeah.
That's awesome. He's the guy that holds crazy, up the man. Signs, right?
Yeah.
I love that guy.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and then just like the whole family, really, like, you know, all of them, they still hang out. We used to practice in the Funkadelic basement where they originally like came up with the jams and stuff like that for the Funkadelic stuff. And even back to like the times where they had like, where the Funkadelic actually started off as a doo-wop band.
Right. The Parliaments. So,
That's right. So, we kind of grew up in that, and we practiced in the same basement, and, times are different now. New Jersey wasn't really the spot to become a band, but I do try to bring that culture out to Austin, and we're still working on it and being like the offsprings of that. And that's definitely like a cool kind of thing to carry with us, because we are pretty much like the offsprings. Like, we are the people that came next in this generation, and, you know, we're proud of that. You know, it's something that we definitely want to live to, and we definitely want to use that name. Like, to all of those kids are from Plainfield. They grew up with the Parliament Funkadelic family, and this is kind of what they're doing now, and this is what that has evolved to. So that's where the musical journey started, man. We all did church stuff together, we all did gospel choir together, and you know, jams and stuff like that. And all of the dudes are like church musicians, some of them are like pastors now. And some of them, like us, are doing stuff on the road and making records. So
that's great, man. Did you even grow up on records like Maggot Brain and stuff, like the real weird shit?
Man, dude, absolutely. Kid It and Quit It, Maggot Brain. I mean, every Funkadelic album, Red Hot Chili Mama. I mean, I know that's, I guess in that sense, I did learn rock early on. That was probably the only, but, yeah, man, I mean,
yeah, that band was literally like as far as I'm concerned, I don't think there are many sort of like unbridled, like freaky ass dudes on acid making psychedelic, like profoundly psychedelic music.
It's crazy. And to see like, to see some of those people in their old age now and kind of just pick their brain, like, just ask, like, yo, what were you guys talking about? Like, what does any of that mean? And they were just like, yo, we were in there, we were high out of our minds, and we have no idea what it didn't mean anything but what it meant in that moment.
Yeah.
And, you know, it may have meant nothing. But in that moment in time, that when you turned on that record and you listen to it, it has meaning, and it could mean whatever you want it to mean. It's about the personal journey that you go on listening to that. Songs like Maggot Brain, it says Mother Earth is pregnant for the third time, for y'all have knocked her up. And for me, that sort of just wording is just so crazy to hear on a record. It just... you may have no idea what that meant, but you're definitely going to squint your eyes and say, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah.
And it interests you, because when that first, when you hear the pluck chording, and you start to hear the guitar solo by A. Hazel, and it's just like, damn, this is like, they were somewhere else when they did this. And
yeah,
when you hear the snare, the rim shot with a tape delay on it, and it kind of just reverberates out, and it's like, this sounds insane. And that's like some of my first experience with music. So it went from like Barney to that. And it was like, whoa, what the fuck? And it was sick, dude.
That's killer. When you started going and seeking out your own music, what were you going into?
I spent a lot of time, obviously, because of just like where I grew up and what I grew up around. I had my phases of like different music. So early age, like before I could, you know, when I was in the back of my dad's car, cause my dad was like a roadie. So he went with Parliament a lot and, you know, drove with them to like San Fran, and we get high with the band and stuff like that. So, that was like, so when my dad growing up, like that was like the, you know, what we listen to. But when I got into like high school, middle school, I got real heavy into like hip hop and, you know, R&B and the more urban music, which I'm glad I did, because a lot of people, like my guitar player, never got into that stuff. It was just straight classic rock his whole life. He never listened to the new stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm glad that that background and like what was current and what was popular and what people were listening to, the young kids were listening to. So I had my phase up until like maybe like my sophomore year, and until my brother went to my brother's a year and a half older than me. So my brother introduced me to like an artist named The Weeknd.
Oh yeah.
And then I had like this whole different era of like moody kind of real ethereal haunting music that I would listen to, and I got into like some of the stuff that was more avant-garde and not, you know, on the radio. And I had my phase with that for a really long time up until I moved to Texas, and that's what I listened to. And then when I got to Texas is when I learned about the blues, and I learned about rock and roll and Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath, and got it more into Jimi Hendrix and all these different artists. And then, you know, I guess not until now, I'm really just looking back on all of the different phases, the Parliament phases, the hip hop phases, the avant-garde phases, and really, like, I really feel like this is the moment for the first time where I'm really taking all these different elements and putting them together, which is where you get something like the newer version that we're going to show you pretty soon of The Riot in the Streets. And
dude, that's quite all right.
But yeah, what I was saying was that This pandemic it's finally given us the opportunity, or given me the opportunity, to like look back on all of the phases of music and kind of create a melting pot of like what that means and what that is. So like, is it like Outkast mixed with like rockish almost stuff and with soul, more soulfulness, and it's like rock but it's soul, and it's like even digging back to like my roots of where my family is from in the U.S. Virgin Islands. So it's a little bit of like Caribbean influence to it in a tasteful way. But it all kind of is founded upon like heavy bass and heavy drums and sort of heavy, thick, very gainy and very like crunchy guitar stuff that kind of just creates that ugh inside of, you know, so that real urgent, that drive kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's always, and a component that I love. So I try to like bring all of those things together.
Well, man, I really love what you're doing, man. And I'm really looking forward to hearing what else you do. I really want to hear what you do with White Denim and whatever you're working on with Adrian Quesada. What a great talent. That's another guy that's moving the needle forward a lot, I think.
Yeah. Adrian and I, along with a couple other people, are working on like a song for the city. Sort of like a We Are the World kind of thing.
Oh, awesome.
And it's actually something that's happening all over the country. All the different cities are doing, like all the different major cities like New York and Chicago, and doing like these songs, a part of a project. And Adrian hit me up to be a part of that. So I'm working on with him on that, and working on some new songs with White Denim. So those are,
I'm looking forward
cool.
to hearing that as well.
Yeah, man, the stuff that they sent so far has been really cool, and I keep missing them, but I was supposed to go over last week, but I'm going over probably next week to get with them and, you know, work with James, who's the mastermind behind the whole White Denim thing.
Yeah.
And man, definitely looking up. It's cool. I really want the live industry to get back.
No shit, man.
Man, it's pretty sickening. But man, you know, I'm using this time. I don't mind the time. I've never had this much time in my life, so that feels like weird. But at the same time, it's like, damn, I don't have to worry about leaving next month. Like, I don't have to worry about shows. I don't have to worry about band rehearsals. Like, I can just work on music. So
yeah. Well,
cool.
Hopefully we'll get some time to work on music, so when we get back out there and start playing live, we'll have some new ammunition, you know?
Absolutely.
So is there anything, I know I'm probably leaving a lot of stuff out, but it's been great talking to you and getting to know you.
Yeah, Michael.
Yeah, man. Let's, we should stay in touch. I, I truly appreciate you as an artist, and you're a really fucking cool guy.
Thank you, brother.
Yeah, man. And I'll let you know when this comes out and everything, but people can find you at samhoustonmusic.com. There's stuff on Spotify and the streaming services and stuff. There's the video on YouTube for Riot in the Streets, or since we've been talking about it so much. But yeah, man, and I look forward to hearing that. I'll send you all the stuff when it gets back together. The Parliament Funkadelic connection is super super cool. Did you see that documentary that's on like Amazon Prime about them?
No. Is it newer?
Yeah, it's from the last like 4 years or so. Yeah. I've watched every fucking music documentary in the world, like, available, or at least I'm trying to during this quarantine. That's my thing.
What is it called? Do you remember?
I think it's called I'll send you a link to it, and I'll tell the people afterwards. There's some sad stuff in the way that George kind of treated the people and the way that he paid them during the cocaine times, but there's still, I mean, just what a magical sort of music that group made, you know?
Man, that was a different kind of culture, different time, different things going on.
Yeah.
It was crazy, though. Like, I didn't live it, but I got to hear the stories directly from it, and...
I bet that must have been amazing.
It's insane stuff, man, to, like, have heard, like... I don't know, you can just look online, man, but that guy, George Clinton, used to come on stage with, like, hospital gown with absolutely nothing under it.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember who the band was that they toured with where he just refused to put clothes on when he came out, and there's photos full on of his dong and everything coming on stage fucking naked, but he got thrown off the tour immediately. I can't remember who it was. Somebody threw them off immediately.
I don't remember either, but I know he did that for a fact. Like, he would just come on stage, show the whole crowd his junk.
Where are you at that point as a performer where you feel like really the only way you're going to get your point across tonight is to just walk out there bearing it all?
See, I don't know. You got to be a different kind of high to do that, man. Like, he was walking on stage butt naked.
Yeah. Yeah, there's photos of it in that documentary. It's pretty frightening.
I think it's absolutely hilarious. Yeah, actually. Yeah, man.
Well, man, it's been great talking to you. And black rock star Sam Houston, your singer, songwriter, and producer. I'm excited to see Sam Houston and Black Odyssey performing when it's time again. And and great job on those live streams, by the way. I know that's not easy to do, performing to no one at a place.
That sucks, man. But yeah, I appreciate it, man.
Yeah. Well, I'll stay in touch. I'll send you a link to this stuff, and I'll send you the name of that Parliament Funkadelic documentary in just a minute.
It's good to finally connect, man, so I appreciate you. Yeah, thanks totally. For having me on.
Yeah, great talking to you, man. Good luck with all the recording.
Thank you.
What a talent. Black rock star, singer, songwriter, and producer Sam Houston. Find him at samhoustonmusic.com. What a great conversation, man. I really enjoyed talking to him. Also, it was very touching to hear the story about his brother, man. That's very moving, especially after all we've been sort of like going through, to meet somebody who's experienced that firsthand and to kind of get the story out how family has to rebuild, how people have to rebuild after they lose someone that they love to police brutality. Anyway, my hat's off to Sam Houston. I hope he is finishing up that version of Riot in the Streets that I want to hear so badly. Find him at samhoustonmusic.com. His EP, April, is available wherever it is you stream and download your jams. You can find him on he's doing a lot of like live stream special shows with a lot of different artists. So you can probably find all of those online, those performances. Just go to samhoustonmusic.com or follow him on Instagram or Facebook or wherever it is you follow people. I really enjoyed my conversation with him. I want to thank him for taking the time to talk to me. Great, great chat. I also want to hear what he was doing with Adrian Casala and Charlie Sexton and another guy in a face mask. All right, let's hear the rest of this beautiful song. Make Me Do from Sam Houston's April EP. Go find it now wherever it is you stream and download your jams. And listen, gang, have a great day, whatever it is you're doing. I'm thinking about you. Stay safe, stay healthy, and stay sane. And don't forget, make sure you're registered to vote. Make sure you're registered to vote. Let's get down.